This is a Resonance FM podcast. If you enjoy the unique nature of Resonance FM programming, please support us on resonancefm.com.
Small.
Kuchek.
Smaller.
Kuchektar.
Smallest.
Kuchektarin.
Six plus to Persia.
This is Six Pillars to Persia. You're listening to the weekly show where you get a soundbite from the Iranian community and its diaspora. And we're going to hear today a talk from Art Basel Miami, where they're discussing the third in a series of talks around subjects to do with the Middle East and Islam and art from the Middle East. And this is an interview with Ali Kadra, founder of Canvas Magazine. And after that, we'll hear an extract from the talk at Art Basel Miami itself.
Six Pillars to Persia.
With Ali Kadra, editor-in-chief and publisher of Canvas Magazine. Just before the Gender Wars and Chadors talk, please tell us, Ali, about these talks that are going on. This is the third one in the series.
This is the third one, as you said. It started in Art Basel, Switzerland, and we had a very interesting and important turnout of people. We had over, 60, 70 people who attended the talks. You see, all three of them have the same topic, but they come in three different aspects. The first one is targeted to collectors. The second one was targeted to curators. And the third one was targeted to artists, cutting-edge artists. So you have the same topic, but you hear three different opinions from the art market. What constitutes an art market, of course, is the collector, the curator slash gallerists, and the artist, obviously. So it was very interesting because we heard three opinions, different opinions, and all three of them were very different from one another, which gave us the idea of launching a book in March in Art Dubai.
The main theme being, how does the chador and women's roles affect art? Is that it?
The main objective from this talk is really to raise the issue of controversy, raise the issue of censorship in the Middle East, the issue of religion, the issue of politics, translated in art form. And how does all this affect the production of the art and the talent of Middle Eastern artists? And we discovered a lot, really, from collectors saying we buy so-and-so and we try to avoid buying such works, or we can buy that, but we can't hang it in our homes. For example, nudity in some Islamic country, or political expressionism in politically sensitive countries, so on and so forth. So it raised really a lot of interesting topics and interesting subjects that have been tackled now in other forums, such as other debates, other discussions. The press was very active about it, and the magazines wrote about it, and we're going to produce a documentary out of it.
That'd be great. I'd love to see it. It's really interesting because often the subject of sexism in our history here in England and other countries, European countries, it's carried so much with it, the right to be different, the right to express your ecological views as if they were spiritual views and so on. So it's interesting to see this, although it's titled Gender Wars and Chadors, working as a vehicle for so many other issues coming out in terms of censorship and so on.
Well, the title in itself, Gender Wars and Chadors, was different. Initially, the title was supposed to be Sex, Bombs and Chadors, and then we thought this was a bit too strong. So this is why we kind of decided to change the title completely and call it Gender Wars and Chadors. It's less provocative. We didn't want to offend anybody. And I know that this could be a very offensive subject. The idea of sexism, as you said, in the UK, or any other topic related to censorship or religion or whatever, cannot be discussed as freely in the Middle East as in the UK. Unfortunately, we don't have the complete freedom of speech in the Middle East. This is why one has to be extremely careful. Sometimes it's not just about saying your own opinion for the sake of being of having freedom of speech, but for the sake of why offend these countries that have constitutions that's different than the one in the West. The world is not all the same. Countries are different. Religions are different. Why not respect that? I don't see it as provoking or as pushing the envelope to the limit or to hurt someone. But why hurt somebody? You know, if this is a topic that is not to be discussed in such territories, fine, I will not discuss it over there. I'll discuss it elsewhere. But it doesn't mean that I cannot express my opinion elsewhere. And it should be expressed outside.
Interesting. It's interesting to hear your angle. It's definitely something I think that discussion can provoke a lot of thought, and it's very important in art to have discussions, because without it, you know, we're left alone. It's very isolated, just you and being the viewer looking at the art. And I think with discussions such as this, and having someone like Hans-Ulrich Oberst to run it, who's omnipresent with every discussion that's ever happened anywhere about art at any time, it's really important to provoke discussion, because even though you're saying you don't want to upset anyone, it's still something that people may feel is slightly sensitive and wouldn't approach in a public space without someone like you setting it up for them.
Well, besides the fact that Hans is a very dear friend and someone I highly respect, I think Hans is really spot on for this discussion. If anyone would raise the topic of censorship without fearing anything in the world, it would be Hans-Ulrich Oberst. And, you know, he's proven that. He has a wonderful track record in terms of interviews, in terms of creating debate, in terms of making the obvious instead of hiding it. And I couldn't think of anyone better for this talk. And Miami, out of all places, you know, this is the perfect climax for Gender Wars and Chadors to end, because it is the third and last one. And he's going to also write in the book, and all the other moderators also are going to be writing in the book.
Our speakers, Kara Ameo, Kara Atia, and Akram Zatari, we're incredibly thankful that they've all accepted to come to Miami and be on this panel. We're going to address some of the topics which are announced, and also some other topics we discussed this morning at breakfast. And I'd also like to emphasize that actually this three-part panel is going to become a book very soon.
Okay, so please tell us a little bit about the artists talking at this third and final Gender Wars and Chadors talk.
Well, the first artist is Akram Zatari. Akram is from Lebanon. He digs up remnants from the not-too-distant past of Lebanon and the wider Middle East, of course. The stories from each work are so in-depth, and he's very passionate about it. He's very passionate about documentation and is driven by an intense curiosity. Akram also has to be credited for his co-founding of the Arab Image Foundation, which is the only one of its kind in the Middle East that keeps the region's history alive and relevant.
Well, because obviously Lebanon in the 80s suffered so much, and I heard that he was taking photographs even as a teenager in the 80s documenting what was happening. Some of these photographs come from way back then. So it's very interesting to hear that he set up this foundation as well to preserve images of what's happened, because really we haven't really understood or seen anything from Lebanon apart from Waltz with Bashir.
Absolutely. You can see these images. They're very interesting, actually, to look at. You can see them on the, of course, the Image Foundation site, and you can see them also at galleries. Andreas Fair-Semler, who represents him in Lebanon and in Germany. The second artist is Gada Amer, who uses embroidery to create artworks of such beauty and revamps the tradition in a sense. She has an acute sense of her gender and the role of womanhood, which filters, of course, in her relentless artistic journey. Abstraction and eroticism are combined into charged works, as you see from the artwork. Her focuses include gender, sexuality, and love. It's very interesting. And the third artist is Kadir Atiya. Of course, as a North African living in France, Atiya's works are charged with the difficulties of being non-national immigrants. Atiya constantly pushes the envelope, which items like handcuffed spiderwebs or a sculpture incorporating the Star of David with Islamic crescent. It's always about the amalgamation of culture, religion, and their influences.
So Gada, the lady amongst the three, is sometimes using slightly pornographic images behind her embroidery.
Absolutely. It is Gada Amer. She's from Cairo. She lives in New York. And Gada Amer, of course, is an Egyptian artist who's based out of New York.
Right. And also I saw in the press release a lot of photos of transvestites in slightly Hindu dress. Was that right?
Yes, this would be Kadir Atiya. Mm. Exactly.
Right.
And Kadir, when we met for the first time was actually in the late 90s, and you had just done your legendary piece, The Landing Strip. And you told me earlier today that this piece, 10 years later, it would still be difficult to be shown in many parts of the world.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the story is very interesting because actually I've been invited twice to show in Algeria, in the Museum of Modern Art and Contemporary Art. And so in a public space, and they told me, okay, we can show everything, most of your work except this one. And actually the issue of transsexuality and transgender issues in Algeria is totally different than in other Arab countries. Maybe it's more because has Algeria for now 20 years have to deal with Islamic issues is something that is, there is a kind of paradox situation. Just people say, especially the transsexual I filmed, they told me, in Algeria you can do whatever you want, but don't make politics. And this work, The Landing Strip, is not about sexuality, actually. It's about politics. It's more referring, in a way, that the story of sexuality of Michel Foucault teach us how sexuality is a political issue. And especially because, finally, you see men that are dressing as women and trying to keep the tradition.
Yeah. That's very interesting, because a lot of people don't understand there's a kind of tolerance within societies. I mean, certainly I saw in India, there's a whole community of hermaphrodites who live together, and they're given the space and there are traditions to keep them safe, or at least to keep them with an income. A lot of people don't know, for example, that in Iran there's a huge Jewish population represented also in the government, who've been there since time immemorial. So it's interesting to see these artists sometimes picking out the fallacies that we've got about Islam and showing them to us in kind of garish ways. It was wonderful to see that.
Absolutely. And this is why when they do the shows, for example, here in the UK, like at the Saatchi Collection, it did a lot of noise. And a lot of people were interested really to learn more about the community, the religion aspect of it, rather than just the artwork. Of course, the artwork was there. It was beautiful. It did great reviews. But also it's what behind the artwork. And this is exactly what shows such as the Saatchi Galleries show do to raise awareness. And they all are labeled as cutting-edge artists from the Middle East and Arab world. It is very interesting to hear their opinions, because when you say the term cutting-edge, it's not really underground, but it's no fear. Cutting-edge is really being more extrovert, being very outspoken, and not really fearing censorship. And this is why we wanted to invite them to this talk, because we wanted to have the true opinion of the artist. We don't want an artist that is bound by, you know, either a religious boundary or a political boundary. Mm-hmm. So they're really very free. Mm-hmm. Most of them live in the West, and they have no fear of really saying their opinion out loud.
That leads us also to Akram, because you said earlier we should talk about sex, and that's maybe another topic. You've not only exhibited worldwide and been extremely involved at the same time in Beirut, also in curatorial activity. So I think last year you curated an exhibition there. And you've told me in previous conversations that there is a sort of a difference between the things happening, for example, in Beirut in a sort of a private context, and then what would happen in a public museum.
Sure. Well, the first, I think we all know that censorship is a very smart organism. So it tries to convince the public that it's actually defending the rights of an individual. So it tries to convince religious authorities, for example, that it's defending religions. But in fact, it's just like any power organism, it's after power. What it aims is to control, as opposed to defend. So from there on, I, in my experience, if you shy away from censorship, if you accept that your work is diffused in a specific context and not on television, not films for theatrical release, for example, you can easily escape censorship, and as if you turn your back to it. All of my films were never sent to the censorship office to get a license for theatrical diffusion, and none of them were sent as a script, because in Lebanon, and like in many Middle Eastern countries, for films you have to get your script approved first, and then you go shoot your documentary or your film, and when your work is finished, you send it for approval for release. And if you decide not to do any of that, you're completely covered. That is one thing. One other important thing is that censorship differs of like what is sticky, what is tricky, differs from culture to another. And we're talking about this earlier with Ghada and the group. For example, in the Middle East, in Lebanon particularly in the 50s and 60s, very often most of the boys, most of the kids are photographed naked, because it's a way to be proud of the fact that you have a male son as opposed to a girl. So every family, almost every family, would have a portrait in a studio, in a commercial studio, the boy opening his legs, showing his genitals, and it's, I mean, these are not considered, I mean, they're not eroticized images, or at least they're not considered as eroticized images. In 1998, I did a project taking these pictures as a model for doing the same poses with adults. And all of a sudden, like you see, like in the Middle East, people would be would see it awkward to see a man opening his legs and showing his genitals, but would not see that as an odd thing for a boy. Once I sent the little publication to Belgium to be sold, and the bookstore was shocked and said, "No, we don't show we don't yeah in Belgium we don't show or we don't accept to sell." Publications with images of naked children. So here is a completely different context.
You know, it's very commendable that you're doing so many things outside the magazine, because bi-monthly is very frequent and it's a large magazine, and as you almost mentioned, it's a kind of work of art in itself. So picking the artist for an event like this and arranging it all is a huge project. How do you manage with time?
Well, it is a huge project, but it really comes naturally. I mean, once one is so involved in the, you know, Canvas began as just a publication, as I told you. But then it went a step further and a step further after that, where it became really the catalyst of the entire Middle Eastern art business. And also it became like it's holding the torch to kind of embellish and enhance the reputation of the Middle East, as we mentioned earlier. But what comes with a publication, you see that these magazines are just going on the newsstands. We don't know who's reading them. We don't know what's happening after that. Seldomly we receive the comments from the readers every now and then. But we wanted to take this a step further and really be in direct contact with our readers. So in order to do so, we have to create panel discussions. We have to create blogs online. We have to create the website, which is www.canvasonline.com. And it was fascinating to see that we have over 253,000 hits per month. 50% of those hits are from the U.S., and 20% are from China, and about 10% or 10 plus from Norway. And this is a great indication for us to know where we should promote more such discussions, where we should promote the art from the region. It gives you a great insight on the market.
I mean, certainly in radio, user-generated content is much sought after because they want an input from their listeners, and they do things such as competitions, phone-ins, or I suppose magazines do letters pages to get people to write in. I mean, even if you're not publishing it, at least you're receiving a letter from your readers, and that's always an insight, although it's very time-consuming.
It is very time-consuming and very costly, and it's exactly like, as you mentioned, like the radio or like television. Again, same thing in publishing. I mean, you're broadcasting out of the radio, but we don't know who's listening. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many are listening and where are they. And in order for you to have a grip on the market, you have to create an interaction with the market, with the audience, and this is exactly why you do talk shows, why you have listeners that you invite online, or on the air rather. And same thing with Canvas Magazine. For us to have a grip on the market, we have to create these debates and invite these. Of course, we do other events as well. We do a lot of parties, we do a lot of gala dinners, we do a lot of panel discussions such as these. Interaction with the market is very, very crucial. It keeps us alive, it keeps the Middle Eastern art message alive, and it keeps us progressing. Without hearing what the market has to say back, how can we progress and evolve?
Great, well, I'll be first in line for the free DVD when you do the competition.
Well, I'll make sure to send it to you by FedEx.
Great. Well, it would have been interesting also to hear from some women. Did you have some women in the previous talks?
We had women in the previous talks. We had, in the collector's talk, we had Mariam Eisler. She's a collector of Iranian origin. We had also, in the curator discussion, we had also Rose Issa and Dr. Venetia Porter. And, of course, the third one, we have Gada Amer.
I couldn't tell from the names, and I looked at their artwork, and I really must say they were really exceptional pieces of artwork that I saw.
As I said, they're very cutting edge, and you don't find this artwork in the traditional, conventional collector's home. It is mostly available in the very avant-garde collector's home and avant-garde new collections, and they're very much collected by museums around the world.
Great. So I wanted to bring up a subject a little bit around the chador, because something I've seen, certainly in this country, you know, as sexism has been slowly and hopefully eradicated, it's taken a long time. And there was even a time in this country where women were covering their hair. You know, it's something pre-BC. So do you think that Luchador, even if possibly one day it becomes a thing of choice, it will still have this invisible legacy, as we've seen in European countries? We call it the glass ceiling, or, you know, that kind of sexism that still remains even though it's not visible.
Well, you see, I mean, you're calling it chador. Let's call it the women covering their hair. Let's call it the cover. Okay. The cover exists in almost, if I'm not mistaken, every religion in the world. I'm not sure about Buddhism and Hindus, but I know that it does exist everywhere in the world. Look at the Orthodox Jew. Look at the Muslim Shia. Look at the Muslim Sunni. Look at the Catholic in Sicily. Covers are everywhere around the world. Again, it is how media interprets it. Mm-hmm. There was a very interesting exhibition about the women's veil, I think it was called. Let's call it the veil, not the cover. Mm-hmm. The veil. There was a very interesting photography exhibition in Lebanon about 5 years ago. I forgot the name of the artist, although he's a friend of mine, the photographer. He had a very interesting show about all the veils of Lebanon, different religions. They're all done differently. You know, the model is different, the texture is different, the cutting of it is different, the design is different, and the fabric, of course. But at the end of the day, it's all covering the woman's hair. So it's all veiling the woman. Mm-hmm. So again, the misperception of the chador, you only hear in the media about the Islamic chador, but you never hear about the Catholic veil. Mm. But it does exist in every religion around the world.
That's true. I mean, certainly if you look at old figurines of Mary, she's always got her hair covered, and we forget that she was from Palestine. And then also still in our weddings today, the bride wears the veil down the aisle.
Exactly. So it does exist, you know, as I said. So if you go to Sicily or Sardinia or other areas in Italy, religious areas, you still have the women covered completely. And look at the nuns in churches. I mean, they all cover their hair. Yeah. But you never hear of that. You only hear about the Islamic veil, because it's a very sexy topic today. Everyone talks about it. You know, you never hear at all in the media a nun covering her hair. It's not something interesting to talk about. But a veiled woman walking on Sloane Street, this is a scandal.
Yes, the nuns tend to be very keeping to themselves, and we see them as, you know, sort of holy women who've taken a choice. But it's very difficult to see the Muslim woman as a holy woman who's taken a choice, because she's much more daily. She's much more out there. She's shopping, she's got her babies, and she just, because of media possibly, we see her as a woman oppressed or making a decision out of fear, even if it's her own personal fear that God won't accept her if she doesn't cover her hair. And I think that's slightly because of the media and what we've seen in the past about Islam, but also because it's something in England we've kind of left behind.
Well, it's all about information. I mean, if anyone would do their homework, one thing that I shouldn't use the word blame, but the community needs to be more informed. I don't blame the community, by the way, because the media does not portray that. You know, I don't blame a Westerner to freak out when they see a veiled woman or a man with a beard, because the image that this man with a beard or this woman with a veil has been wrongly transmitted. This is why I don't blame the West to be afraid. But if the West would take a step further and do a bit of research and understand this community that is called the Muslim community, and that it's not all about the 4 or 5 terrorists that are on television. There's a whole other world out there. There's a whole contemporary Islamic culture. There's a whole contemporary Christian culture from the Middle East, whole contemporary Jewish culture from the Middle East. If people would look into that and stop narrowing their mind and vision towards what the media is portraying, the media feeds us. But it is our duty to do research and to learn more about communities around us, because they're living around us.
So these talks are a kind of research, aren't they? It's wonderful. When are you going to release the documentary?
The documentary should be sometime in 2010, I would say around autumn 2010.
Great. Well, it's a wonderful project, and it's great to see Canvas doing things beyond and above the call of duty. Have you got any other extracurricular plans for the next year?
We definitely have, but we're going to keep it as a surprise so that you interview me again.
Great. Well, we wish you all the best with the talks, and maybe we can hear about the book when it comes out.
Thank you very much for seeing me today.
Six Plus to Persia.
But you said also this morning when, you know, we looked at the title of these three panels and you saw gender in the panel, that we should rather talk about sex than about gender?
Yeah, I think there are enough non-governmental organizations in the Middle East working under the title of gender, which is more about identity politics, sexual identity politics. I think we live in a place where sex is not even accepted, or is not accepted to be addressed in public, although it takes place in the public sphere, but in the private sphere. But it, I mean, I don't know if this is a kind of pudeur that people don't like to talk publicly about their sex life, and when they hear others talking about
their sex life, they get annoyed. It has to do with it, with the Arabic society, maybe, I don't know. It has to do with the Middle East, and the laws are derived to protect this. So I think we should start talking about sex before starting to talk about identity politics.
Do you agree with that?
But we speak about sex. Remember the video we saw in, within a religious context. So we can speak about sex if the prophet or said, like, this is how you should have sex. So this we can talk about it. But
sure. Yeah. So, I think, you know, I think I never heard speak about sex so much than in the Middle East. I mean, in a society in which you try to forbid something, people develop maybe in an underground way all the... And what is interesting at that point is that it's not only in the outward of the Middle East. This is very popular that people in the Middle East speak all day long about sex.
Yeah, actually, it was very, very interesting to see that YouTube thing this morning, because we all of a sudden went on YouTube and looked at this amazing film.
Yeah, that was a TV program that we watched this morning on YouTube, showing an Egyptian TV presenter reading passages from a book that tells how you should treat your wife on the wedding, on the first wedding night. And it was too explicit that the presenter could not even read some of the passages. He would say, like, you know what I mean by his hand was inserted there. And the thing is that this is like your first wedding night. People don't want to hear about extramarital affairs or about people having sex outside marriage or people of the same sex having sex. Of course, you hear about that among friends in the popular conversations, but these conversations are never get the legitimacy of the public sphere, in my opinion.
There's this beautiful Arab proverb which say, do whatever you want, but don't tell to anybody. I think this is Egyptian.
Now, let's move on to war. We were also wondering, in terms of going through all these topics the previous panels have addressed, and it was interesting also to see, obviously, I mean, Akram, you said in terms of war, in terms of having a very direct confrontation, that is obviously something which always played a very, very major role in the work, so maybe we could start with you.
Well, I mean... I'm a kind of artist who are very much concerned with his social, political entourage. So it's inevitable when you live in a country that is tormented by war, that have gone through a series of invasions from many armies and withdrawals and then invasions a second time. So it's inevitable not to talk about war. I think it would be falsifying things to shy away from that subject. But of course, my work is not restricted to this. I have basically three axes in my work, an interest in sexual practices, an interest in photographic documents, and the study of the history of those photographic practices, and the third one is territorial conflicts, invasion. Having this question, like, what happens to a territory that have been invaded several times and that have undergone withdrawals of these invasions. So for me, like, if you do an excavation in, if you do an archaeological excavation in a city was tormented once by a volcano, it's inevitable to touch on this level. If you do an excavation in the desert, it's inevitable to encounter so and so and so.
Right, so you've been listening to Six Pillars to Persia. If you've just joined us, this is Resonance FM Art Music Station coming at you right from central London. That's the end of Six Pillars to Persia. We've got some good news for you. We had an event earlier on last year, and we raised a lot of money for Amnesty, and we did that at the Gingrich in Shepherd's Bush. Six Pillars is planning to host another one on February the 25th, which is a Thursday, so put it in your diary. We've got lots of interesting Iranian musicians for you, some coming from Scotland, some coming from France. And next week on Six Pillars, we'll be hearing from Mariam Namazi talking about her One Law for All campaign, which is campaigning against Sharia law for the UK. And after that, we're going to hear about something that sprung up in Iran in the 70s. It's called Kung Fu Torah. and it's a specifically Persian branch of Kung Fu, and we'll be going to the class to hear how they do that. So that will sound very interesting. And also, coming up later in the month, we have something from the East Central Gallery, which I'd urge you to go and see, Shoja Azari and Shahram Karimi with their show Blazing Grace. The rest of that talk will be podcast on the Six Pillars to Persia website. That's http://sixpillarstopersia.wordpress.com.